From the OnStar Studios in the Motor City, Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. What a program we have in store for you on this OnStar remote. As I look out over the Detroit River, I'll tell you about that in just a second. But we're talking ghosts tonight, and then some open lines later on in the program just for you. Yep, I'm back home. This is where I was born. Had an opportunity to see my parents today. And you know what? The clock really goes by quickly, and all of us should spend a little more time seeing our parents because it does go by very, very fast. But here I am. I'm way up in the OnStar studios overlooking the Detroit River, and I can see Windsor, Canada, and it's all lit up, and the city's all lit up. There was a Detroit Tiger game tonight, and that was kind of neat because from my room I was able to peer down and see part of the ball game, except everybody looked like they were half an inch tall, but I still saw part of the stadium, and that's incredible. But I got to tell you, last night, as soon as Coast to Coast was done out of the cave in St. Louis, I took a nap for 2 hours, and then I had to get on a plane to get to Detroit because I had some meetings that I had to attend to here before we got ready for the program tonight. And I just want to thank all the folks at GM and OnStar for their graciousness and everything that they're inventing. And I can't wait for the day that they invent teleportation and I don't have to fly. I can just beam aboard and I'll be here in the studios. Here's some of the news of the day. Here we go again. The Chinese recall of the week. Simplicity, it's a company, a supplier of baby furniture to Walmart stores and other big retailers, recalling about 1 million Chinese-made baby cribs, which have been linked to at least 2 infant deaths, according to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. The drop sod can detach from the crib, parents be careful, which can create a dangerous gap that leads to an infant being trapped and suffocated. The safety agency said in a statement that it is urging parents to check all Simplicity-made cribs to ensure the drop side is installed correctly. I mean, a parent's worst nightmare, isn't it? The cribs, priced between $100 and $300, sold by U.S. retailers and chains, including Target, Big Lots, and the family-owned major stores as well. A major advance in fertility treatment is signaled as doctors are unveiling details of a technique that will allow human eggs to be grown in the laboratory from ovarian tissue samples. The procedure, which is being pioneered by 2 British fertility clinics, involves taking a piece of ovary tissue from a woman and banking it in a laboratory until she's ready to start a family. They say this would allow a career woman or those waiting to meet the right partner to delay motherhood for years. Man, science is going too fast. International drug company Merck has halted trials on an HIV vaccine that was regarded as one of the most promising in the fight against AIDS. Merck stopped testing the vaccine after it was judged to be ineffective. A gunman remained on the loose Friday after shooting 2 students at a Delaware State University and forcing the campus into a lockdown as police searched for the suspect. They are looking for a male suspect. They've identified 2 persons of interest. Both are students. Actor George Clooney suffered a broken rib and some scrapes when the motorcycle he and a friend were riding collided with a car as the actor tried to pass the other vehicle. I don't ride motorcycles, but in Los Angeles, when I drive, people go buzzing between you. They allow that to happen in L.A. They don't in St. Louis. But if you love motorcycles, be careful. Be careful. A tropical depression came ashore in the Florida Panhandle, sparing coastal Louisiana and Mississippi, the first serious brush with tropical winter and weather since 2 hurricanes laid waste to the area in 2005. Not winter, it's weather. The Financial Times has announced the government of Abu Dhabi has made an investment in the Carlyle Group, a Washington-based private investment firm with close ties to former President George H.W. Bush and his family, as well as other top government officials in the Reagan and Clinton administrations. A wholly owned investment arm of the Abu Dhabi government bought a 7.5% share of the Carlyle Group in a transaction in which the deal price was struck at a 10% discount to a valuation of $20 billion for all of Carlyle. On the line with us now is Jerome Corsi, who broke this story for WorldNet Daily. Jerry, this entire situation in that region of the world, Abu Dhabi, the Emirates, they were involved with the port leasing, and I don't think they've released those ports yet. And now they're trying that area out there. They want to buy 20% of NASDAQ. What's going on? Is America for sale?
America is for sale, George. I think that's the reality. The United Arab Emirates have something like $1.3 trillion in sovereign funds. These are just funds the government has to invest. They've accumulated them because with oil at over $80 a barrel, the windfall billions that are going into countries like the United Arab Emirates is just, you know, it's enormous. And now with this newfound wealth, they're trying to buy assets, and they've turned to the United States, of course, Dubai, which is a different one of the Emirates than Abu Dhabi. There are seven Emirates in the United Arab Emirates, as you know. And now this Abu Dhabi, through an investment arm known as Mubadala, they announced that they're making a direct investment into the Carlyle Group, a 7.5% share. And, of course, the Carlyle Group is a Washington-based investment group with very close ties to the Bush family. Former President George H.W. Bush is a senior advisor and has gotten numerous untold fees. As a private group, the Carlyle Group never discloses any of these financial details. Also, James Baker, another tie from the Bush administration.
Former Secretary of State.
He has also made, I'm sure, millions from the Carlyle Group.
And didn't that company, don't they buy under-financed companies and they build them up, they build up the business, they build up the assets, and then either they sell them or they keep them. But what concerns me the most here, Jerry, some of these companies that they buy in the Carlyle Group are defense companies, aren't they?
Well, yes, or aerospace related. That's been the most recent purchase. I documented today in WorldNet Daily that Dubai has now bought two companies from Carlyle. They are both Carlyle Group's Landmark Aviation and Standard Aero Holdings. Landmark Aviation is an Arizona company, and Standard Aero Holdings is Canadian. These are companies that repair jet engines. Standard Aero even repairs military and private jet engines. And, of course, you know, with the 9/11 hijackers having been involved in hijacking airlines, and you've got a Dubai company, people forget that Dubai was named, you know, the United Arab Emirates was named in the 9/11 commission reports as having done the banking for the 9/11 hostage takers, the terrorists, who, you know, hijacked the airplanes and flew them into the World Trade Center of the Pentagon. Dubai was actively involved in helping them with their finances. It's controlled by a sheikh. It's clearly an Islamic country that has, you know, Islamic Sharia law, and they have worked and supported with terrorists. And to assume that our interests are going to be identical with the United Arab Emirates or Dubai, this is an issue that surfaced last year when Dubai Port Holdings was trying to acquire a British ports company, and they were going to have operations then, Dubai Port Holdings, in up to 22 U.S. ports. And the American public, in an outcry, said we did not want a Dubai company managing U.S. ports. It was a security issue, a national security issue. And now through the Carlyle Group, working with the Carlyle Group, they're not only working hand-in-hand with investment interests from the Bush family and the Bush-Reagan administration officials, they're buying aero companies, air-related, like these two aviation companies that deal with jet engines.
Yeah, it's strange. Well, keep your eyes on this one for us, Jerry, and keep checking back with us.
And okay? Dubai's also trying to buy 20% of NASDAQ, as you know, another investment group. And we've never sold one of our stock markets, and it's going to be very interesting to see if Islamic law begins to apply in the operation of the stock market with Dubai having 20% ownership.
Okay, that's Jerry Corsi. Thanks, Jerry. In a moment, we will come back with Linda Godfrey. She's one of the most respected authorities on anomalous animals and paranormal phenomena in Wisconsin. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Michigan. We'll take phone calls with her a little bit later on as well. I'm George Norrie, live at the OnStar Studios in Detroit, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Well, as I mentioned, Linda Godfrey, she is a respected journalist, does a lot of work in Wisconsin. She was the first to break the story of a terrifying werewolf-like monstrosity lurking in the shadow-shrouded forests surrounding Elkhorn, Wisconsin's Bray Road. Godfrey has continued to pursue her interest in the unknown and has gone on to investigate an array of unusual animals apparently lurking in her home state. And she's with us now on Coast to Coast. Hey, Linda, welcome. How are you?
I am great, George. Thanks, and I'm so glad to be here.
So now you're moving into Michigan with some of these spooky stories, huh? What's
yep.
going on there?
Michigan and points beyond. Well, Michigan is just one weird state, and it is chock full of creatures, which you might well expect, being completely surrounded almost, well, not almost completely surrounded by water and filled with it besides, along with many deep, dark forests and wonderful places to shelter these things.
Are you scared of any of this, Linda?
Well, it depends on where I am when I'm thinking. If I'm standing out in a field at midnight wondering if one is around me, I tend to be a little scared. But, you know, the weird thing is that over many centuries, they go back to 1936 or earlier, the sightings, and hundreds of people as far east as New York State, down to the southern states, as far west as Iowa, nobody's ever been hurt by one. They think they're going to be eaten if they get caught. They are afraid of it. They are scared to death, too scared to tell people often for weeks and weeks. And yet the creature always seems to stop short of actually hurting someone. So
yeah, that's funny. After my producer's weekend, if one of these animals had taken a bite out of him, they would have been feasting for the next couple of years. He had a wonderful time. I know, and I know where you're coming from on this. Let's talk about some of these very strange episodes, Linda, that seem to be going around in Michigan. And later on, next hour, I want to open up the phone lines because I'd like people from all around the country and in Canada to call and check in with you because I am sure you're going to get some incredible stories about things that are happening there as well. I was raised in Detroit. I was born here in 1950. There have always been very strange cases, weird things, old houses. The area, it seems like some of the older areas of a city seem to be the scariest or the most haunted. But you seem to specialize a lot in the unusual with the animals, first and foremost, and then, of course, you study other things. What is it about these animal investigations?
Well, it really is intriguing to me that so many people have seen these things. And the people, by and large, with very few exceptions, are sober, credible witnesses with nothing to gain by telling it. They usually are not wanting to tell it. They have to be coaxed by a relative or somebody else in most cases. And what they are describing is so often so very consistent, it just seemed to me there had to be something to it. And I decided 15 years ago to just keep looking into these things as they came my way, trying to make correlations, map things out, compare them with old Native American legends, and see what I could find to make sense of it all. And that's still what drives me and keeps me going.
Let's go through some of the cases, Linda, and then you can kind of tell us a little bit about each one. Tell me about the Le Nain Rouge, the red demon that apparently has appeared in good old Detroit, is a harbinger of disaster since 1701, almost like the Mothman. Whenever he shows up, it shows up, there seems to be a disaster. Tell me about this red demon. What is this?
I'm so glad you made that comparison, George, because I had come to the same conclusion, and I have some other comparisons, too, that have come up. If you see my book, Weird Michigan, they did a great photo illustration for this where there are scenes of burning cars and riots and old buildings. And Le Nain Rouge means the red dwarf. And it happened way back in 1701, centuries ago, when the city's founder, Monsieur Cadillac, was warned by a fortune-telling gypsy that he should appease and flatter this demon called the Red Dwarf, and he just kind of put her aside, didn't really know what she was talking about. And about 6 years later, he and his wife were out walking when this thing appeared, about 4.5 feet tall, glowing eyes, it was red, and instead of appeasing it or flattering it, he hit it with his cane. You know, which is
tough guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Not maybe brave, but kind of foolhardy. So right away, things started going downhill for Cadillac. He was arraigned for questionable trading. They removed him to Louisiana. He got worse and worse and worse, started losing his fortune, hightailed it back to France, and he finally died there penniless. So it was said that the Red Dwarf ruined him. And then it kept coming back. That wasn't the end of it. It was seen in 1805, just before a fire happened that burned down about 200 buildings around the city. Just a massive disaster, loss of life. A few years later, this an elderly woman was attacked by it. She said that it was leering, red, baboon-headed. And in 1967, it was seen just before the huge riots, where 43 people died in July. Happened again in 1976, when two Detroit Edison workers at first thought they saw a small child scampering up a telephone pole, and when they looked closer, the so-called child took a great flying leap from 20 feet up, landed on its feet, and...
Sounds like Spring-Heeled Jack, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It sounds very much like Spring-Heeled Jack. Bounded off, monkey-like. And it's been seen from time to time whenever there is a disaster coming to the city.
In the riots of the 60s, and I was here for that. I saw
really?
That. I witnessed that and was not yeah. good. Do you have any knowledge of this demon being around then?
Well, yeah, it was supposed to have been seen by several citizens who reported it just brazenly strolling around, walking the streets, and, you know, as if, you know, who cares if you see me? It's about, you know, all hell is about to break loose.
All right, well, that's the Red Demon, and we don't know what's become of it, right?
No, I think people are kind of holding their breath, hoping there won't be another appearance, since the last documented one was about maybe 30 years ago. But there's a new book out by Nick Redfern called Man Monkey,
yes.
which documents, it's a great book, and it documents some very similar incidents of a, you know, shortish monkey-like creature that sort of flies out at people and sounds very much like it. And
as a matter of fact, I'm going to bring Nick on the program in a couple weeks to talk about that.
Oh, that's great. It's a wonderful book. If nobody has read it, I highly recommend it. But I relate it to that and to Mothman. To our own, Wisconsin has what I call the man bat, which is kind of a similar creature but with bat-like wings that was seen over in the western side of the state only 3 days before the last round of the infamous college student drownings in the Mississippi River that happened in that
mm-hmm.
city. So it seems to be sort of a pattern.
What about the werewolves of Detroit?
Yes, we go back to the 1700s again for that, because...
They all start during this period.
They do. Detroit is an old city for this country. Because it was such a great spot for fur traders and the early missionaries to come. So it really had an early foothold. So you have wonderful tales from the 1700s and a lot of French settlers. And, of course, the French brought with them their tales of the loup-garou from France, the French werewolf. And some people claim that it stowed away on the ships and literally bodily came over with them. Others claim that they were just able to recognize it when they got there. But there are many tales, often revolving around religious things. For instance, there was a werewolf that fell in love with a young woman who became a nun. Yeah, so it sneaked up on her while she was praying in front of the statue of Virgin Mary one day. And just as he was about to leap, the nun fell on her face in ecstasy before the Virgin statue. The werewolf kept going, found itself staring straight into the holy statue's face, and that was the end of the werewolf. The holiness killed it.
Okay, very good, Linda. the werewolf and the nun, that's an incredible story all by itself.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Linda, when we come back, let's also talk about the ghost of Knock Knock Road, if we can, and really dive into that. Now, the the work you've done, how do these stories come to you?
All different ways. I do a lot of researching in old historical documents. I'm kind of a library nut. I love to just, you know, sit and dig in old papers and books and things like that. And also, with the miracle of the Internet, people are always writing me wonderful things.
All right. Well, stay with us. We'll talk more about these ghosts when we come back. I'm George Norrie, live at the OnStar Studios in Detroit, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And this city just continues to fight back. In spite of all the tough things that have occurred here in Detroit, they are doing a marvelous job. And I got to come back here more often. They are building things in places that I never knew you could build things before. You know, I used to, when I first started here, I was 19 years old. I worked for ABC. At the time, it was called WXYZ Television, Channel 7 here. And I was a copy boy. And they had me driving around. And during those days, we had film for news. We didn't have the video like we have now or the live remotes. It was on film. And one of the things I had to do was meet the crews wherever they might have been, pick up the film and rush it back to the station where they would develop it. And then they'd have a film editor actually put this together with a reporter. And that would go on and on. And I knew this city like the back of my hand. I knew every nook and cranny in a huge metropolitan city, how to drive, where to get around. The police officers knew me. It was amazing. And I almost forgot spots. And that's not supposed to happen. Everything's supposed to come back, right? That recollection. They've changed things. It's really strange. Tommy's here with us, and he came in on a different flight. He came in straight from L.A., and he rented a car, and he has no idea where he's going at all. He just showed up just a few minutes ago. Anyway, Ian Punnett on Saturday. He hosts the show and anchors our weekend there. What's on store for the weekend, Mr. Punnett?
What brings you to Detroit, George?
I'm here for the OnStar Studio broadcast, which I do once a year.
That's great.
And then it also gives me a great opportunity to see my parents that are getting up there in age. Dad is 83 now, and my mom is... It's just kind of nice.
So it has nothing to do with your book coming out in paperback?
No.
You're not there for a signing or doing
anything
like that?
No.
Will you be touring again on the paperback?
No, I'm not going to tour on the paperback, but I am working on another one. But the heck with the book. How about you? What are you doing this weekend?
Oh, I'm doing terrific. Thank you for asking. It's going to be a great show tomorrow. Two things. We're going to revisit the tapeworm economy discussion with all of the latest news about foreign ownership of U.S. Wall Street
great stuff.
Like the NASDAQ and Carlyle Group, and we're going to talk about what that means to have such a large amount of essentially the engine, or at least the gauges to the engine in our economy, being measured by somebody in another foreign country. And we'll talk about that with Catherine Austin Fitz, and that'll be very interesting. And we'll pick up our conversation, too, in the second hour on the latest in the research and the mysteries of the brain, some phenomenal new things that are being discovered. And we'll do that with a mother-son writer combination team who've been working on this book about mapping the brain, the body maps of the brain.
That's incredible stuff.
How we think about ourselves through these weird little tunnels in our head.
Ian, Tom was on a plane sitting next to a guy who had just had brain surgery. And he was showing Tom the scar on his head. And he held up his fingers 3 to 3.5 inches wide and said, "That's the amount of stuff they took out of my brain."
How about that?
Man, how'd you like to be sitting next to that guy? Tom's the kind of guy that if you prick your finger, he can't handle it.
Well, and this is an interesting thing. I bet you that man's brain, to this minute, still thinks that all of that material that they took out is still there. And that's part of the body map experiments that they're doing, the way that the mind still maintains the original blueprint for our bodies and what it means for us, coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast.
All right, sounds like a great program, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, we're with Linda Godfrey. Linda, the ghost of Knock Knock Road and other urban legends, where the heck is that road?
That road is actually called Strasburg, just south of 7 Mile. And I wrote it myself. I did not get to see the little ghost, but it, I could see where it could show up, you know, if you were there at the right time. And the great thing about these urban legends is there is always more than one variation on it. The main one that I heard was that a little girl was riding her little tricycle, veered out into traffic, got hit, was killed, and that she never left the road, that she stuck around, and that if you're on that road late at night, you might hear a knocking on your door and look, and there's a little girl knocking on your car window trying to see if you were the one that hit her.
Now, see, is that one of those myths? Because I hear some of those in different cities.
Right, yeah. I think that can pretty safely be classified an urban legend. There's a variation on it that the knocks came because, this one's a little more gruesome, a carload of teenagers was speeding and had a terrible accident on the road, and the car caught fire, and the knocking came from them all trying to knock on the windows to get out of the burning car.
Oh, man.
And I think that one has shown up in other cities, too. So, you know, it's just one of those urban legends that you have to chronicle. And there are so many of those great stories around Detroit and Michigan all together.
Linda, assuming some of them are true, what does that tell you about the paranormal world? What's happening over there?
You mean in Michigan particularly there?
All over the place, I guess.
Well, you know, it's hard telling whether some of these things did have a kernel of truth. And, you know, I think I've observed this in certain places. One person will have an experience and tell the story. And then others hear that, and they're attracted to come and see if they can have the same experience. And sometimes perhaps maybe they do. Other times they might be influenced by shadow or just think they saw something, and yet they go back and report it, and it grows that way. From something that maybe really happened to the original person.
This is a great story. It was investigated by MUFON. It might have been a UFO landing case called the Mud Lake Ice Circle. What do we know about that?
Yeah, this one I find really fascinating. Michigan is full of UFO stories. The publisher did not even use half of the UFO stories that I submitted, but one that they did put in that I was really glad about was the one on Mud Lake by Horton, which is kind of an out-of-the-way, it's just a little tiny lake, and this man who lived on the lake one time thought he saw a really, really bright light out there. Couldn't figure out what it was and kind of shrugged and went, huh, you know, this was in the middle of winter, so he wasn't real inclined to go out there looking. And then when he did get out there a couple of days later with his son, he noticed that out on the lake was a perfect circle melted into the ice. There was no normal natural explanation for that.
No footprints, right?
No footprints. Nobody had been there. It's a rather isolated place. I drove around out there, too. I put like 5,000 miles on my car researching the Weird Michigan book and the follow-up that's coming out, Strange Michigan. But there was a 3 to 4 foot wide ring, 40 feet across, with white snow in the center. And then outside the ring was an additional sort of pattern of that kind of radiated outwards from it as if heat or something had affected the area around the circle in a certain pattern and radius. And he called in the Mutual UFO Network from Michigan,
right,
and had even Linda Moulton Howe, who is, you know, quite a well-known researcher,
sure,
came in to look at it too.
And what did they conclude, if anything?
Well, one expert concluded that it was formed by normal hydrological processes, but if that's true, you'd think that you'd see these things in lakes all over the place. You know, I find that one hard to buy. Another thought maybe it was wind, but nobody could explain the brilliant white light that this gentleman, Von Hobie, first saw before it was caused, nor could they explain the fact that he had been seeing illuminated orange spheres hovering over the lake. He had even chased them on a snowmobile. So you've got weird lights going on. You've got this real anomaly. And one researcher, this I thought was the most amazing thing of all, he took some of this ice, where the strange patterns had formed outside the circle, melted it, and watered some plants with it. Then he had a control group of plants that he just used normal water on, and he discovered that the plants grown with the water from the splash pattern grew 174% faster than the plants grown with ordinary water.
Now, that's incredible.
I think that's bizarre, yeah.
It is weird. Energized water of some type.
Exactly. Somehow, whatever caused this ice circle, the brilliant light, transformed this ice and did something to the water that gave it extra nourishment for plants.
And then basically the investigation was over and that was it.
Pretty much. Because, you know, the ice melted, they had to just go by the original samples and photos that were taken, and MUFON was kind enough to contribute their photos for the book so you can see the pictures of it. But
well, I'm glad you've been able to keep some of these stories alive, Linda, because, you know, without this,
yes,
they'd die and nobody would ever know about them.
That's one of my main goals, George, from the folk tales to these odd, bizarre, unexplained phenomena. If somebody isn't documenting them and they don't get in the normal history books, people just do forget.
Tell me, let's jump to Wisconsin for just a moment.
Sure.
And then we'll get back to some of these others. And we're rapidly coming up to the top of the hour in 10 minutes. We'll open up the phone lines for you next hour. What was this horrifying werewolf story in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, anyway?
That was what really started this whole journey for me. I was working as a reporter for the county newspaper at the time. And believe it or not, in my own hometown, people had started reporting that they were seeing something called a werewolf. And my reporter instincts went up because they weren't just, it wasn't the kind of usual prank thing where there are just teams with rumors and that sort of thing. People were calling the local animal control officer for the county and saying, I saw this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what to call it because I've never seen anything like it before, but if there was such a thing as a werewolf, this would be a werewolf. You know, I don't think it was, but that's what it looked like. It was upright. It was 6 to 7 feet tall, covered with hair, walked on its hind legs, eating roadkill, or kneeling, running, walking. And when I went to visit the county animal control officer, he showed me he had an actual manila file folder that he had labeled werewolf because he didn't know what else to call it. That he was.
Did anybody confuse this for a Bigfoot at all?
Not at that time, because they could clearly see that it had the head of a German Shepherd or wolf. It had pointy ears on top of its head, a muzzle. It was not nearly as large as a Bigfoot. It was, you know, the size of a fairly good-sized man, you know, between 6 and 7 feet tall, much rangier and leaner, especially around the hips, and it walked on dog or wolf-type legs. You know, it did not have the big primate flat feet. So nobody was saying Bigfoot at that time. I've had a few people try and characterize it as what they call a snout-nosed Bigfoot, which to me is like calling a hyena a snout-nosed chimpanzee. You know, they're two very different things.
Have you been looking into this case of a chupacabra? And apparently it's all over the country, Oklahoma, Texas, the Midwest. It's all over the place. And this thing looks like a boar. It's got fangs coming up from the bottom. A woman has the head of one of these things. She had the whole carcass, but kept the head and froze it.
Yeah.
And she's got some DNA samples that they're taking. I don't know what's taking so long.
Yeah, it's taking forever. I'm dying to find out what that turns out to be. It'd be great if it is some kind of unknown species. I find the chupacabras a very fascinating animal. And, you know, it relates so much to lizard men, what, you know, people call things by whatever name comes to mind, and you get reports of lizard men, reptile men, that sort of thing, and I've had several of these just in Wisconsin. The lizard man was seen coming out of the Mississippi River in La Crosse. There was another one up by Medford where some highway workers and a patrolman saw what they called a lizard man because it was standing covered with scales in the middle of the highway, Highway 13, and they saw it snap wings out from behind its back and sail over the trees.
Now, how do we know it's not some guy, Linda, in a costume? on a case like that. Some guy who puts a lizard outfit on and just goes wandering around, walking out of fields, coming out of the lakes. I mean, that's kind of stupid to do that, because someone's going to take a shot at him.
Yeah, I find the lizard man reports harder to ascribe to that sort of hoax than some of the other ones because of their behavior, because so often they shoot straight up from the ground and take up off into the air, which would be really hard unless they've got a jetpack, you know, for a human to duplicate that. I do know of a couple of instances where people have hoaxed the Beast of Bray Road after the fact, after many of the sightings have come in. It doesn't negate the original sightings, but I know one man personally who admitted to me that he put on a bear suit and went out there until it dawned on him that somebody might shoot him.
Yeah, not smart.
No, no. Another in a gorilla suit. There were a couple of teenage boys who put on a mask. But whenever you have some kind of monster hotspot, you get all kinds of people tempted to go out and do crazy things like that.
When we were kids, the myth story had to do with these lover's lane spots, and a couple would turn on the radio and hear some broadcaster come on and say, you know, someone has escaped from an insane asylum, get out of there.
Right.
And, you know, he's got a claw for a hand. And then the people would get home and they'd find the claw stuck on the door.
Or caught in the window where they tried to roll it up real quick.
In those days, they had those old doors that, you know, kind of curved so you could just grab onto it, and there was a hooked hand there. Now, well, see, those were myths, right? They didn't happen, did they?
Well, you know, strangely enough, in my first book, The Beast of Bray Road, I have a story about a man from northern Illinois who was out parking with a girlfriend in his cornfield. And this is a first-hand story, not a friend of a friend. I know this man. They were sitting in this isolated cornfield when they felt the car rock from some outside source. And so, of course, you know, they looked up from their activities, and there was something black and furry covering the driver's side door window. And they got all scary, and it rocked.
You mean like black, furry, and slimy, or like an animal?
Like an animal.
Okay.
They, you know, were trying to straighten themselves up and figure out what it was, and it rocked it again. And what they could see of it, he thought, almost looked more Black Panther-like than anything else.
Well, that's possible. We get reports of those.
We do.
I mean, legitimate, real reports.
We do. You wouldn't think one would want to rock a car like that. I've thought to myself that he thought maybe it was one of the man-wolf, you know, wolf-like creatures. I think that he probably didn't get a great enough look at it to rule that out or to rule out Bigfoot either.
Linda, tell me about your book, where people can get it.
All my books are available at Barnes & Noble and other big bookstores, on Amazon.com. I plan to be offering autographed books from my website in the near future, and you have the websites kindly listed on your screen there.
All linked up for you.
Yes, very nicely. Thank you very much for that.
I'll tell you what, when we take phone calls next hour, what I would like is people to call you with either some of their urban legends and myths that they've heard. I want you to tell us if you've heard them or not, what you think of them, and other stories as well. Now, of everything you've investigated, which one just knocks your socks off?
Well, I think
you wear socks.
I do quite often wear socks. I think probably it has to be one of the most recent investigations, which was three people getting chased by the wolf-headed creature just south of Milwaukee this past June. Very startling. It ripped the man's shirt. I have the shirt in my possession. Scared the bejabbers out of
the living bejeebies, as we say.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That one, because I found footprints there. Footprints that match up with large, strange canine prints that are shown in Hunting the American Werewolf, and that other investigators have told me they have found.
But now the footprints, did you ever get it cast? Were you able to have that analyzed?
I have not been able to get a good enough cast. Either the plaster of Paris hasn't worked, or I've had a fair amount of footprints. I've had I have good photographs of them next to a ruler. And they really don't look like anything else. Nobody's really been able. They look like a strange elongated canine, and they match exactly the footprints diagram by a funeral director from Georgia in Hunting the American Werewolf, who encountered this thing in a swamp and drew a diagram. He didn't have a camera with him at the time.
All right. Well, you stay with us, Linda. We're going to open up the phone lines now, give you an opportunity to chat with us. And what we'd like is, of course, for you to fire away at some of your urban legends and myths or other stories that you think are real. We'll do that next hour before open lines. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.